I'm Marty Moss-Cohen. Welcome to Radio Times. The University of Pennsylvania recently announced new rules for handling reports of sexual assault. These procedures are in response to new guidelines established by the Department of Education's Office of Civil Rights. Advocates say these new policies are needed because victims are often reluctant to report abuse and worry that they will not be believed if they do. A group of professors from the Penn Law School wrote in an open letter that these new rules risk trampling the rights of the accused. So today on Radio Times, we examine the new rules and talk about the rights of the accusers and the accused. And we have two guests who have joined us here in our Philadelphia studio. Carol Tracy is executive director of the Women's Law Project here in Philadelphia, also on the faculty of the University of Pennsylvania, and Bryn Mawr. Carol Tracy, nice to have you back with us on Radio Times.
Thank you. Good to be here.
Good to have you here. Also with us is David Rudofsky. He's a civil rights lawyer here in Philadelphia, a senior fellow at the Penn Law School, one of the authors of this open letter. And David Rudofsky, always a pleasure. Nice to have you back with us on Radio Times as well.
Good morning, Marty.
Before we get deep into our discussion here, I just wanted to read a part of a letter that we got from the University of Pennsylvania saying, we developed a process that we believe to be fair and balanced that will provide a sensitive and effective process for those wishing to make a complaint while actively protecting the rights of the accused. We hired a skilled and experienced Title IX investigator to manage the new procedure and to help educate our community on this issue. So I wanted to make sure our listeners heard part of that letter. Carol Tracy, if I can begin with you and kind of an overall question to you as well, David. Is there a need for new rules, new guidelines when it comes to allegations, cases of sexual assault on college campuses?
Well, actually, the guidelines aren't particularly new. David and I may disagree with some parts of it, but in 1997 and again in 2001, the Department of Education issued guidelines. I think part of the emphasis for them to reissue and restate some of the guidelines that they did in 2011 arose in part because so many college-age women are complaining about sexual assault on campus. So I think the clarification of the rules, the clarifications of the standards of proof is what the publication was about. And it was a wake-up call to colleges and universities who for years have been turning a blind eye towards sexual assault on campus.
You want to respond to that, David?
No, I think I agree. I think what brought this to a head, though, was in the last couple of years with the Department of Education, the Office of Civil Rights, now providing more specific requirements for colleges and universities. We'll talk about it because in a lot of ways universities and colleges, in my view, have gone beyond even what the Office of Civil Rights has said is required in these types of proceedings. But for sure, it's been an issue for years. It's been brought to a head, as I say, in the last couple of years with these investigations and new rules.
I mean, this is a really basic question. Do you both agree that there, and I'll put this to you, David, that there is a problem of sexual assault, sexual violence on college campuses?
Absolutely. One of the problems is we don't know the extent of it. And you've got these studies that are out there that show huge numbers of complaints. You have other studies that show fewer. We don't have very good data. But there's a problem out there. No question about that.
Carol, how does it work today? And based on your experience with women, largely women, who have been accusing others of sexual assault, what happens to them? Let's say they go to their university. What is the typical procedure that happens?
Well, I'm not sure there is a typical procedure. I mean, I think that it varies from campus to campus, that it's been way too idiosyncratic. What should happen is that an investigation should occur. There should be a way for the student to find out what their rights are. If one goes through university websites, one generally winds up totally confused trying to figure out what's going on, whether or not they should report to the police, whether or not they should get a forensic examination done. There's an awful lot that is involved. You know, I think one of the things that complicates this issue for everyone is that this sexual assault is a form of sex discrimination and a violation of Title IX, which is a civil rights law. It's also a crime, and it's one of the most serious crimes. So I think that the individual who has been assaulted is pretty traumatized, wants help from the community, wants help from her own community first and foremost to be safe and to obtain some sense of justice, and generally doesn't know where to turn. She should be able to find it very easily. Most, you know, people have handbooks, but as we know, students today live on computers. So they should be able to find accurate, concise, directive information on how to proceed. And they frequently don't. I know as lawyers, we have researched websites and walked away thinking, what are they talking about?
It's not even clear
to you. How do
you
do it? No.
David, let me go back to you. One of the things that the University of Pennsylvania did, which was to hire an investigator, someone whose job it was to look at these allegations and I guess determine if something had occurred. Is that something you're comfortable with?
Yes. And in fact, we're comfortable with a lot of things that Penn did and which we think other universities ought to do, which is the preliminary report, the preliminary investigation. Penn has built in a system where they will now provide much more protection for someone who comes forward. They can complain with confidentiality. They can be advised of their rights whether they want to seek criminal prosecution or keep it within the campus community or do nothing. They can make that decision. All of that has been set up. They have hired an investigator. We have no problem with that, to look into the allegations. Our problem is at the end of the process. For those cases, and it's a pretty unusual case that gets to a full hearing, because oftentimes these are resolved one way or another before it gets to that point with the full investigation. Our problem is what kind of rights should be instituted at that stage. But we have no problem, and we applaud the university for increasing protection for people who come forward, to encourage them to come forward, to give them confidentiality and counseling, and to have a proper investigation. We have no complaint with any part of that.
But are you concerned, or are you and some of these other law professors that signed this letter, that the accused person is made more vulnerable by this process?
At the hearing stage, it is. This is where I think we differ. Assuming that the investigation finds a credible complaint, that is the investigator, and now they've got an experienced former prosecutor who will investigate this, assuming that person finds it's a credible complaint, in other words, believes the complainant and doesn't believe the accused student or the respondent, then the student who's been accused has a right to a hearing.
Mm-hmm.
The problem is there are almost no protections at that hearing. And you got to think about the dynamics here. There will be a full report. It could be many, many pages long as to why the investigator thought that a sexual assault of some kind had happened. That report is given to a 3-person faculty panel. That panel can re-interview the people, but they already have the report that has made a credibility finding. The accused is entitled to have a lawyer there, but the lawyer can't do anything. It's literally your potted plant lawyer. Now, the lawyer can do nothing at that hearing except talk to his client. There's no cross-examination.
Can he advise his client to answer a certain way or not a certain way?
No. He can advise him as the proceeding goes along. He can't cross-examine any witnesses. And so basically what you have is a hearing that's a non-hearing. That's our fundamental complaint with what Penn has established.
Let me get you to respond to that, Karen.
Well, actually, I don't disagree with a lot of that. I mean, I think I disagree with some of the evidentiary standards. I think that there are problems with the investigative report being handed forward. I also think that there should be opportunity. I think that generally university procedures have hearing officers do questioning. And I think we don't want to over-judicialize university campus disciplinary hearings. So I think that there should be an opportunity, whether it's the typical kind of cross-examination or whether the hearing officer gets questions, additional questions submitted that the hearing officer asks the other party. I think that's a possibility. I think that there, and that's where I agree with, I think Penn is trying.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know that any of us have seen the perfect. I think the imperfect has been around so long, where the victims have been mistreated so much that we're in the process of developing what is going to be the best practice, and I'm not sure that it's there yet. And in many respects, I think having the kind of discussion that we're having here are the kind of discussions that should be taking place more openly and robustly in colleges and universities.
But you're saying these discussions are not taking place?
I don't
think to your satisfaction?
Not to the extent that they should be. And I think they should be much, you know, I think that the major problem is that right now everyone is focused on compliance and dotting their I's and crossing their T's. And of course the universities can and should be in compliance with laws and regulations around sexual discrimination. But I also think colleges and universities have an opportunity that they're squandering right now, which is they are educators. This is an educational community. We need to find out what is going on. What we have seen here, what we've seen in college tribunals, that was seen in police departments, prosecutors' offices, judges, and juries, is very deep and pervasive bias against rape victims that just assume they're lying all the time. And that we've got to get at.
Well, and do you think conversely, David, that there are incidents where accused are not believed as well? I mean, that they have a credibility problem under the system?
Well, there is. And as I say, it's that number of cases where there is a credibility question. That's not going to be an issue with kind of violent assaults. What we're talking about, which are the really problematic cases, given the codes that are being set up at universities around the country, for example, that require affirmative consent before we think there is actually consent.
Like, yes, you can, right?
That's right. It's no more no means no. We've gone through that phase. And now colleges are phasing in, and I don't disagree with it, as a matter of conduct and morals between human beings. That affirmative consent, however we define that, but it's an ambiguous concept. I mean, is it spoken consent? Is it some kind of sign? It's infused, as I've said, by alcohol, and I'm not talking about situations where people deliberately spike alcohol, but this is voluntary drinking, and so you have two people who know each other. They're both been drinking. There's sex, and then there's a complaint. Well, I didn't say yes, and that dispute.
Is that really what we're talking about here?
One of the cases that I'm concerned about, that when that gets to a hearing and we try to determine, right, he said, she said, there's no other witnesses, right? When we try to determine what happened in that situation, when the accused student faces, if he's found guilty of that, right, expulsion, being branded as a sexual predator, that's a serious consequence. And all we're saying is that in that kind of situation, have a fair process to determine what happened. At the end of the day, if you determine he violated, right, school regulations, take serious action. But let's not forgo the process to get to the punishment.
Hold on to that thought only because we have to take a very short break and then we'll get back to our conversation. That's David Rudofsky, who joins us along with Carol Tracy. We are talking about the University of Pennsylvania, but other universities as well, recently announcing some new rules on handling sexual assault reports. And David Rudofsky is a senior fellow at the Penn Law School, one of the authors of an open letter raising some concerns and some questions about the process. We're going to take a very short break and then get back to our conversation. Stay with us. We'll be right back. This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscoen, talking with Carol Tracy, Executive Director of the Women's Law Project, and Civil Rights Attorney David Rudofsky, also a senior fellow at the Penn Law School. And we asked him to join us on Radio Times. We saw recently that the University of Pennsylvania announced some new rules for handling sexual assault reports. The new procedures are in response to guidelines set by the Department of Education's Office of Civil Rights. Now, victims' advocates say the new policy is sorely needed, but in a letter, a group of Penn Law professors, including our guest, has expressed concerns that these new rules may trample the rights of the accused. And that's what we're talking about in this hour of Radio Times. Send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org, and you can send us a tweet at WHYY Radio Times. Carol, what David was talking about before the break is something, I don't know if you're comfortable with this phrase or not, but something called regrettable sex, where there is a sexual encounter, perhaps alcohol is involved, and out of that comes an incident where one member of the duo sort of regrets what happened. And sometimes those are cases that are turned into cases and charges of sexual assault. How do we deal with those more sort of murky areas?
Well, you know, I'm not so sure that regret sex is something that is out there. I think that, you know, we live in a world, frankly, of hookup culture and whatever flaws and problems that many of us have with that. Nevertheless, there's a lot of sexual activity that is consensual that is taking place on college campuses. So I think regret sex sort of takes us back to 1950s. Hmm. So I think for me that's kind of off the table. I think the question is, what does it take to establish? And the Department of Education in its letter, and this is one of the areas of controversy, and I think the main area of disagreement that we have with David and others is the evidentiary standard. The Department of Education said the preponderance of evidence should be used. Now,
which is 50.1%,
sort
right?
Sort of. More likely than not.
Gotcha.
But what preponderance means is that everyone comes to the table with the same risk of harm that could be done or credibility, and then one has to figure out, because in most of these cases, or in many of these cases, as David pointed out, there isn't physical injury, there isn't any witnesses, it's just credibility that's at stake. Although I do want to tell you that we, the Women's Law Project, right, has been involved representing women where there has been extreme physical injury, where there's very little doubt, and still the assailant has not been held responsible for his actions. So in those cases, the preponderance of evidence standard is the standard that we think is the appropriate standard. It's used in most civil rights cases, virtually all civil rights cases. It's how OCR investigates. It's much more of a level playing field going into a proceeding. When it's a clear and convincing evidence, if there aren't other kinds of evidence and it's just credibility, the victims are probably going to have a much, much greater hurdle to overcome. So that to me is the biggest disagreement that we have.
And this is an important legal argument, I guess, here, but one that I want to make sure our listeners understand. David,
yeah.
Go ahead.
So it is the Office of Civil Rights has required proof only by preponderance of the evidence. We do have some problems with that. We think clear and convincing is a better standard. We're not talking about the criminal standard of proof beyond a reasonable doubt. It's still a lower standard than that. But the problem with the Penn procedures and other schools that have adopted this preponderance test, and let's assume they have to do it because they're going to have financial penalties if they don't, is that in our view, is if you're going to have such a low burden of proof, at least ensure the other procedural due process rights accompany the accused. So what Penn has done is not only adopted this preponderance test, but has a three-faculty panel. It only has to be a 2-to-1 vote, which means you could have less than preponderance at the end of the day. If it's 2-to-1,
and one person was not convinced.
That's right. That's even less than preponderance. And they have taken away all protections of cross-examination. There is simply no confrontation of the complainant or the complainant's witnesses. So if you're going to have a very low standard of proof, if we think this is a civil case or an administrative case, I don't know of any other situation, literally, in which a party cannot, through counsel – I'm not talking about the student cross-examining the complainant – but counsel posing proper questions. And you can limit the questions to make sure they're not oppressive, they're not overbearing, they're not unfair, there can't be any questions about prior sexual history. That even goes on in criminal cases now. So you can have a fair process even with this preponderance test. I have trouble with it, but even if we're bound by that, at least have the other protections which historically we've used to determine who's telling the truth.
I'm trying to imagine, you know, certain scenarios and what the difference would be between preponderance of evidence and clear and convincing. I mean, if something is he said this, she said that, how do you determine what's clear and convincing and what's a preponderance?
I actually think that the standard is more important symbolically. I think when you have a little higher standard, you're telling the fact finder, be careful. Before you make a determination that can have serious consequences for the accused, you've got to be assured then more that it's equilibrium. You know, maybe yes, maybe no. That we want a little bit more. To put a number on it, is it 65%, 70% sure? Maybe that's the range we're in. I just think personally that's a fairer standard. But even if that's not the standard, at least have the other protections – that allow the fact finder then to really make a proper determination of the facts.
And that's cross-examination.
Cross-examination is certainly, in our view, essential to that.
What do you think of that, Carol?
Well, I think that, as I said earlier, I think that there should be a way, particularly at the hearing, that questions can be asked, probably through the hearing officer, and that it doesn't become a pseudo courtroom. But I think that the issue that that's harder to tackle, and the issue that has to be tackled, is the depth of bias against rape victims
exists still today.
Oh, indeed. You know, the sense, well, she was drunk, so you know, that's free rein. If she's drunk, she's responsible for his behavior. You know, the depth, and one hears this all the time, so that in whatever proceedings that we are aware of, and there's a documentary coming out called The Hunting Ground that is just chilling as they interview student after student, campus after campus, including male students who have been sexually assaulted and simply not believed, mistreated, all of the kinds of biases that actually we've been working with police to help them rid themselves of their biases, you know, the interrogation of the victim rather than the interview. Questions about what were you wearing? What were you doing? What could you have done differently? Those things have, at least according to these young women who have come forward in an amazing way, the bias is really deep. So I think that's there. That's a reality. And as I said, I don't think Penn's procedure is perfect. I think that there are flaws in it.
Do you think that's the reality, that there is a kind of built-in bias?
There has historically been that bias. I'm sure it goes on. You don't address it, I suggest, and I don't think we disagree with that, by lowering the protections for the accused. You address that by educating people about the problem. We should talk more about what you do up front, what universities ought to be doing about problem drinking and relationships on campus. There's a lot to be done there. But I guess fundamentally my response is even if we think there's a large problem, and historically think about other situations where people have thought, you know, the problem is so deep and so serious, we have to give up due process. So we investigated communists in the 50s, right? We took away hearing rights because we had such a huge problem. Today with terrorists, we say, you know, well, maybe we can't afford due process. Now, I'm obviously not comparing terrorism to the sexual misconduct, but everybody's got their fear of a particular type of crime or condition, and we tend to think we've got to deal with it differently than others, and I think we often go down the wrong road when we do that.
Let me read a comment we have from Susan. She says, I see an issue already. If the report is kept in campus community, there's a chance for a cover-up. Rape should be reported to police rather than, I guess, keeping it on campus. And that was a question that I had for both of you, which is, as you said, Carol, this is a crime. If a crime has been committed off campus, one would assume that one would go to the police and it would be criminally investigated. Why a different system on campus?
Well, actually, certainly people on campus can and do report to the police. So both processes should be available. But let's remember, the vast majority of rape victims do not report to the police. They don't report to their schools either, because there is so much stigma associated with rape and there is so much concern that they will not be believed. And that concern is well-founded concern. So we have a vast underreporting of what seems to be, I mean, there's some significant evidence-based literature, certainly on college campuses, that shows that a huge number of women each year are sexually assaulted. So our position, certainly at the Women's Law Project, is both should be available, both need vast improvement, that we need to do both. And actually, if there's any school that I think has a good relationship with the police, it's Penn. I think their Penn police have been very effective in intervening and in their appropriate information to students about how they can use the police. I think there's a vast concern by many people that schools, in many schools, don't do that. And it's probably, again, a well-founded concern.
David, let me go back to you. Excuse me. Are schools, though, and I'm thinking who's going to serve on these panels, do they have the kind of training and background and education and kind of sensitivity to deal with these very, or can be, not always, but can be very complicated issues.
Yeah, I mean, historically, I think they have not. Penn says they're going to do some training of faculty who will sit in these panels. I'm not quite sure what that training is going to be. We want to make sure it's fair on both sides. But that certainly has been a problem. And let me point out one other thing just on this procedure and burden. The irony now is actually when we talk about these burdens of proof, at Penn, if you're charged with plagiarism or assault that's not on the sexual assault, the standard is clear and convincing. You're allowed to cross-examine the complainant. So we've kind of carved out, or Penn has carved out this one special area, right, for what I would call reduced protections of the accused. Now, I understand it's a different kind of crime. There's Title IX involved. But again, I think it's dangerous to start going down that road of kind of selecting what we think is the worst of the worst crimes and reducing protections.
And that's David Rudofsky. Hold on to that thought. I just need to reintroduce the two of you. David Rudofsky, he's a civil rights lawyer here in Philadelphia, also senior fellow at the Penn Law School, and one of the authors of a letter recently, an open letter, I should say, that raised some questions about some new guidelines at the University of Pennsylvania, concerns that some of these new rules may trample the rights of the accused when it comes to allegations and cases of sexual assault. Also with us is Carol Tracy, Executive Director of the Women's Law Project here in Philadelphia, also on the faculty at Penn and Bryn Mawr. And again, to join our conversation, send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org, and you can send us a tweet at WHYY Radio Times. And Carol, you wanted to say something. Do you remember?
Well, I think, what were you saying, David?
I was comparing the different procedures for different violations.
And different schools have different standards. Yeah. So, yes, Penn has clear and convincing evidence. Temple doesn't. It's harder to discipline a student at Penn for plagiarism or other issues than it is at other schools. But the reality is the federal law, Title IX, there should be some consistency about how schools who accept federal funding deal with these issues. And I think that's what makes it different. It's clear that it is harder to discipline a student at University of Pennsylvania than it is in many other schools. Now, to the extent that there is information about this, The surveys have been done. National Institute of Justice, I believe, did a survey that showed that of those schools that do articulate a standard, preponderance of evidence is the standard in 80% of those cases. The reality is that there are a lot of schools that have a much lower standard. And in fact, Title IX is actually elevating that and elevating those protections because many schools have used just a substantial evidence, and courts have found that that's been adequate in circumstances, except in circumstances where what may be alleged is also a crime, which is the standard that Title IX is replicating.
But is it possible to create a standard that covers all colleges and universities, covers all campuses, that both protects the rights of the accused and the accuser? Is this kind of a utopian idea?
I think it can. I'm not sure this ought to be coming from the Office of Civil Rights, and certainly it shouldn't be coming from them without a full-blown discussion. I think one of the problems has been is that this was perceived as a huge problem. It is a big problem on college campuses. I think the Office of Civil Rights stepped in and said, well, this is how we're going to kind of change the playing field somewhat in terms of the standards and some other rules. And that's – I think ultimately that's fine. After full discussion, you could probably have uniform standards around the country. The real question is what those standards ought to be. I mean, we could probably reach that. But the question is what's the fair way of dealing with it, given with the problems on both sides?
Yeah, and I think the other thing we have to acknowledge is that it is the accused and the accused, but there's also a campus community that's at risk. And I think the greatest concern that we have, frankly, is that we know that many sexual offenders are serial offenders. These are not some of the problematic cases that are more sort of outliers, but we have some, significant evidence-based literature that shows that, you know, I think one of the fears always out there, when one says 1 in 5 women are sexually assaulted, that immediately people think 1 in 5 men sexually assault. And that's just not the case. But we do know that there are many very serious, dangerous perpetrators, and campuses are places where that can thrive, because that's where young people congregate. That's where there are far fewer kinds of community structures. I mean, we've alluded to alcohol in throughout this conversation, but sort of the degree to which alcohol and drugs, particularly the interaction of the both, are so commonplace and fundamentally unregulated on college campuses is part of this discussion. And people have used that, serial perpetrators have used that as a tool and find victim after victim.
Do you agree with that, David? We're almost up on a break here.
Yeah, I don't know what the numbers are, but to the extent there are serial rapists on college campuses, that's not the issue we're talking about. Those should not be difficult cases. I mean, if 5 women come forward and say, this guy, right, serially assaulted us, that's going to be a fairly easy case to find fault.
Now, but if she's the first woman,
I understand.
You're saying that's a rarity?
I think it's a rarity to have a serial rapist on campus. Are there men who take advantage of women? Absolutely. And the question is, in what kind of context are we talking about? Is this a physical assault? I don't even know this woman. I'm going to physically assault her. Most of the cases that we see are people who know each other and become involved sexually, and there's a complaint. And I would say most of those complaints are legitimate. I'm not disputing that. There are a percentage that are not, and that's where we have to separate out.
And we have to take a very short break, and then we'll get back to our conversation. Carol Tracy, David Rudofsky, our guests. And we do have some folks that want to join us. I see a tweet here. You can send us a tweet at WHYY Radio Times. Send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org, and call us 1-888-477-9499. Stay with us. We'll be right back. This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscoe, talking with David Rudofsky, senior fellow at the University of Pennsylvania Law School, also a civil rights attorney here in Philadelphia, and Carol Tracy, executive director of the Women's Law Project. And we've been talking about some regulations, some new policies related to allegations and incidents of sexual assault on college campuses, how to strike the balance between the rights of the accuser, the rights of the accused. And you can join our conversation by giving us a call at 1-888-477-9499. David, we have a tweet from Becca. She said, did any women sign the letter that the Penn professors sent?
Yes. The letter was signed by about a third of the Penn faculty, including, I believe, 2 women professors. Yes.
Okay, fair enough. I wonder, though, to you, and you had mentioned this 1 in 5 statistic on college campuses, which I have to say has come under some criticism based apparently on a study that was done that has come under question. I'm not trying to diminish the fact that there are sexual assaults on college campuses, but I want to, you know, make 1 in 5 is, you know, 20% of people saying that they have been sexually assaulted on a college campus. That's an extraordinary number of people.
Yeah, well, I think the research study of that sample population was, you know, published in a peer review journal. So I think that there there are numerous other studies that suggest very high levels. Now, you know, in some respects, if it's 1 in 5, if it's 1 in 3, arguing over that, I don't think is as important as to know that there are significant numbers that are taking place on college campuses. And if one is just paying any attention to the media, day after day after day, there is a story in some major publication about women coming forward. Now, what's amazing today is, you know, for years, rape victims wanted their names and their identity shrouded. The sense of shame that has been associated and blame that has been associated with rape has been very deeply ingrained. So now we have these young women from elite Ivy League schools and many other schools who were saying, no, you know, I am not ashamed. This was not my fault. I did not do this. And they are not just complaining about their assault, but they are complaining about how they have been treated by their university.
Mm.
That's a major issue. If they were treated fairly, they're also many of them are complaining about how they've been treated by their local police, that they simply were not taken seriously. They were not believed. Investigations didn't take place. And in some cases with women that we have been working with, they themselves have been suspended for bringing the charges.
Do you think it's similar for accused, that they are not believed
if
they are innocent?
I think in some situations that can happen. But I do want to respond. I think it is important to get a little better accurate handle on the numbers. There was a study, 1 in 5. There was a study 2 years ago or last year, which was said it was actually much, much less than that, and actually much less than you see off campus. Probably flaws in that study as well. I think we don't know. Again, if it goes on at all, it's a problem. We've got to deal with it. But also the point, and it's true historically, rape victims, people who complain about sexual assault, have not been believed. We have all the myths about that. My simple point is we don't address that problem properly at the other end by saying, okay, because that happens, we're going to take away basic rights for the person who's accused. There's a mismatch there. There's a disconnect.
Yeah. And I just don't think that the person who is accused gets more rights than the person who has brought the allegation. And that's why I think some of the evidentiary standards are important, although I don't – you know, David and I have worked together on a lot of issues.
Have.
So they're – you know, and I think these discussions are healthy and important, and I don't think enough of them take place. In the same respect, I don't think there's nearly enough research. There's nearly enough information about not just the prevalence of it, but why it happens and what we need to do to prevent it. We just don't go there as a society. So to have most of the discussion become polarized around procedures doesn't advance where we need to be as a society. And certainly educational institutions are the place, the best place for these discussions to be taking place.
Because they are educational institutions.
They're educational institutions, yes.
Go ahead, David.
I think we agree on that. I mean, you know, there are problems with culture on campuses, and changing culture is very hard. But I don't think we change it. I think we both agree by what we do with these, you know, the few cases that actually come to a hearing.
Right.
Colleges have to deal with relationships among students, sexual conduct codes, drinking. All that has to be part of the process, probably more important than the procedural stuff. On the other hand, procedure is important. We know that historically.
Right.
And we risk a lot if we're unfair at the end.
Let me see what Steve from Reading has to say. Steve, go ahead. You're on Radio Times.
Oh, great. Thank you. I was a resident director on two different college campuses in the early to mid-80s. I've been involved as a student, as a college chaplain, professor, et cetera, over the years, and seen this going on forever. I have a daughter who's a freshman in college and a son who's a senior. And one of my observations, one of the worst parts of all of this, is that sometimes the security people, the campus police, are no better than mall cops. I mean, they don't have a clue how to proceed, and they often will bury a lot of the complaints that come out or make it impossible for students to do anything about it. And I think that, you know, it's a crime, so it needs to be dealt with as a crime. And I'll take my answer off the air. Thank you.
No, Steve, thanks for the call to Radio Times. David, you want to answer that?
No, I have no no question about that. That probably goes on. I think we all agree Penn police are actually better. And the good part about the Penn Protocol, as I said before, is that it builds in protections. It builds in an investigator. It builds in securing evidence. It builds in confidentiality when the woman comes forward. If she wants to go public, she can. If she wants it confidential, she can. So it builds in all those protections. Whether it'll work or not, we'll see, given the deep problems in the culture. But I have no problem with any of that.
I was reading about Penn State University, not the University of Pennsylvania, but Penn State, and all employees are required to report allegations of sexual misconduct to the officials that they have to keep accurate records, of course. All employees receive annual training on sexual assault. Students no longer serve on panels. Investigators interviewing victims and they must present reports to panels, and that there is bystander training. If we're talking about creating an atmosphere, a place where there is more understanding and education, Carol, does that in any way address some of your concerns?
Well, it's just the tip of the iceberg. You know, I think that many people are relying on bystander training. And there's something that I've just always found very strange about bystander training, that we have to teach a community to intervene when they see something going on, that people are entering a college community not understanding that, not knowing that. So I think that suggests an even deeper problem. And in fact, much of what they've said is required under the DOE guidelines, that all people who know about sexual assault have to report it. What's done with it is a different issue. People who are what are called responsible employees. So I think bystander education has a useful part of it, but I think we need considerably more.
But it sounds like you're saying the fact that we have to actually train people in what to do as a bystander. Yeah. As a bystander, raises even bigger issues about
30 years ago, when I was the director of the Women's Law, the Women's Center at the University of Pennsylvania, I was involved in dealing with an issue associated with a fraternity gang rape. And everyone at that fraternity knew what was going to happen to that young woman. Everyone there, they saw that she was out of control. They saw that she was stumbling. They saw that she was in and out of consciousness. She couldn't go up and down the steps. And yet, no one intervened when 7 or 8 men raped her. So I think that these issues go deep, and these issues need – what I admire so much about the young women who are coming forward now is that they're coming forward and that they are demanding equality, and they are pushing the envelope in the way that it has not been pushed before. I think there's a new movement emerging around this. And it's one that the rest of us really need to pay attention to and support. And a lot of men, I might add, a lot of young men are participating in that movement.
Some positive news there. Let me get Kathy from Ballykinwood to join us on Radio Times. Hi, Kathy. Go ahead. You're on the air.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call.
You're welcome.
My daughter is at a major university in the South. She's a senior, 21 years old. She was assaulted in September. She was not raped. It was an attempted strangulation.
Wow.
She had met the man several times before. He was a grad student. She didn't report for 24 hours because her roommate told her that she was going to ruin this guy's life, and he probably didn't really mean it seriously. She did eventually go to the Women's Center. They were amazing. She went before one of these 3 panels. In this case, it was an administrator, a faculty member, and a student. The accused brought in a heavy-duty, big-time lawyer and a expert witness on strangulation, and they found not enough evidence, although an administrator at this major university sent her an email that said, the fact that the panel didn't find him liable doesn't mean that we don't believe you. So I'm not sure what's worse, that she was assaulted, or they know she was assaulted and aren't going to do anything. The second point, and then I'll leave.
Sure.
Is that the thing nobody's talking about is that the other young women on campus are the worst enemy of these young women who are assaulted. When my daughter was assaulted, her roommate tried to convince her not to report. Several of her, quote, sorority sisters have basically unfriended her because she did this. And that caused her as much pain as the original assault. And from what the Women's Center on this campus told me, that's a very common thing that's happening, is that young women encourage other young women not to report. And that's what I find just mind-boggling. And, you know, I can't understand it. The other interesting thing is that the young men that my daughter knows have all been 100% supportive and behind her. It's the young women. And this is an issue that isn't being talked about.
Mm.
The reason a lot of these women don't report is because of pressure from other women. And that's something in our society that I simply cannot understand.
Well, Kathy, first of all, we're so sorry about what happened with your daughter, and I do so appreciate your phone call, because you raise so many really important issues, and I guess it's one of the reasons why this issue is so complicated, because of the relationships involved and the allegations involved, and even, as you describe, the friends that are involved, if we're talking about a college campus. David, what are your thoughts?
Everything she says rings true in terms of the way sometimes people react. I would make this point, however. Who knows what evidence was presented? But that panel heard it. The fact that there was a lawyer involved, I actually think, is a good thing. Mm-hmm. I think there ought to be lawyers on both sides.
Well, I was going to say, it seemed a little lopsided.
And ultimately, sometimes we make mistakes, right? Both ways in adjudications. We find people guilty who are innocent. We find innocent people guilty. That happens even in the criminal process. I think we have to live that. The problems she talks about are the problems we've talked about that are separate from this adjudicatory process. It's the culture on campus. It's support. It's confidentiality. It's all those mm-hmm. kinds of issues which are a bigger problem, I think. I think we both agree on that. But again, I make the point that we don't solve those problems by taking away rights at the hearings.
Yeah. Go ahead, Carol.
And I want to add that victims very frequently, women who have come forward, are ostracized. There's no question about that. And certainly if they are filing a complaint against a star athlete, they suffer significant consequences. One other thing I want to say about lawyers. I mean, one of the problems, and this may be odd coming from a lawyer, is that unless both parties have lawyers – it doesn't matter on either side. Lawyers have something to do with that family's resources, and an awful lot of kids, either accused or complainants, just don't have the resources for it. So, you know, whether and there just are not enough pro bono attorneys. Let me tell you, we are inundated with requests that we cannot respond to at the Women's Law Project, nor can any other public interest group respond to them. And I'm sure that's true for the accused. So we need to figure that one out if we're going to have lawyers present in these settings, because there is always significant right. there when only one side is represented in anything, there's always a significant imbalance.
About a minute before I have to say goodbye, and David, the response to your open letter that you wrote with other law professors at Penn, what was the response from the university, from others outside the university?
It's interesting. It's a good question. There's nothing from the university. The university hasn't said anything to us. This was part of a discussion we're having at the university over these procedures. They were changed as it developed. But from other people, what's interesting to me, it's not the usual political breakdown, liberal, conservative, right? It's all over the lot. Some agree, some disagree. So I think what is good, I think, and what this conversation is important about, is it spotlights a very serious issue, which we've ignored for many years. Mm-hmm. And hopefully, as Carol has said, it helps us turn our attention not only to the procedures that we ultimately develop that we think are fair, but how we deal with a larger problem of what I'll call culture in this society generally, but on campuses in particular.
On that note, we have to say goodbye to you, and thank you both for joining us today on Radio Times. David Rudofsky, civil rights attorney here in Philadelphia, senior fellow at the Penn Law School. Also with us, Carol Tracy, executive director of the Women's Law Project, which is in Philadelphia, and she's also on the faculty at Penn and at Bryn Mawr. Go to whyy.org/radiotimes to find out more about this program. You can find out how to download a podcast of the show. Send us an email, and you can also find us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter, and you can listen to us on satellite radio. I'm Marty Moscowen. Thanks for joining us in this first hour of Radio Times. Do stay with us for hour two. We'll be right back.